George Clooney, John Turturro, Holly Hunter, and John Goodman star in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Audio Describe. Sunday afternoon at 1 on the Recording Library of West Texas Radio's Sunday Movie Matinee.
You ever been with a woman? I gotta get the family farm back before I can start thinking about that.
I can't begin to knowing, but then I know it's growing strong. Wasn't the spring, and spring became the summer. Who'd have believed you'd come along? Touching hands, reaching out, touching me, touching you. Sweet Caroline, good times never seem so good. Look at the night, and it don't seem so lonely. We fill it up with only two. And when I hurt, hurting runs off my shoulders. How can I hurt when holding you? One, touching one, reaching out, touching me, touching you. Sweet Caroline, good times never seem so good.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 51 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 40s. Then, tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the mid-60s. Tomorrow night, it will be cloudy with a low in the upper 40s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 1 p.m.
Hello and welcome to Entertainment Weekly Magazine. I'm Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Every week I read Entertainment Weekly, actually not from the magazine, but from their website, EW.com. This week I have our What to Watch article, some reviews of movies and television, and also some news from Sundance, which seems to be going on this week, the Sundance Film Festival. And I also have an article I've been saving. It's longer. We'll never finish it in this episode, but if we get to it, I'll explain why I saved it. So first up, our What to Watch article. Anna Gasteyer is back behind the desk of American Auto. A cell phone contains an entire thriller in Missing. What's worth your time in movies and TV this weekend? Entertainment Weekly's critics review the latest releases, Missing, American Auto, Accused, and When You Finish Saving the World. This is by Leah Greenblatt, Kristen Baldwin, and Darren French. First, we're going to hear about Missing, which is in theaters now. Searching, released in 2018, pulled off a neat little trick. A micro-budget missing child thriller told entirely via smartphones and screens. That low-stakes experiment made more than $75 million at the box office, and so we get a sequel. This time about a single mom, played by Nia Long, gone AWOL, and the increasingly freaked out daughter, played by Euphoria's Storm Reid, compelled to find her through any means necessary. WhatsApp, TaskRabbit, Siri, as long as tools to do it exist somewhere in the cloud. By the law of franchises and the built-in restrictions of the premise, it should be diminishing returns. Instead, Missing puts an even higher polish on the original IP, a nimble re-up that's surprisingly light on its feet. Haven't we all cursed a 15th failed password attempt? If also longer than it strictly needs to be. Reed's June, too busy being a teenager, doesn't have time for her mother's anxious attempts at bonding. She just wants to see Grace clear out for Columbia for a few days with her new boyfriend Kevin, played by Industry's Kevin Lang, leaving her to all the house parties and unsupervised freedoms a girl on the cusp of college deserves. When neither June nor Kevin are anywhere to be found on their return flight to LAX, though, Grace has to become her own DIY detective. And when she starts to dig, things do not seem kosher down in Cartagena. Directors Nick Johnson and Will Merrick sometimes strain the credulity of what shooting in-screen can do. June's laptop camera does a lot of heavy lifting, but the movie rarely feels forced or claustrophobic. It's just a whizzing, cannily, of-the-moment spin on a familiar genre, re-upped for the Genius Bar age. Leah Greenblatt is rating Missing a B+. American Auto premieres January 24th at 8:30 p.m. on NBC, and Season 1 is streaming on Peacock. The fiendishly funny sitcom about a hapless car company was a low-key gem in its debut season. I'm so happy NBC brought it back for a second year. And even happier, some palpable last chance to shine desperation is filtering directly into the show's calamity capitalism plotting. Auto's premiere escalates a minor technological snafu into a series of ongoing scandals that engulf Payne Motors CEO Catherine, played by Anna Gasteyer. The trouble brings out all the best, worst instincts in the hilarious ensemble. Sadie, played by Harriet Dyer, tries to spin a press conference and spins out of control. Cyrus, played by comedy sniper Michael Benjamin Washington, eats his feelings. Clueless Sion Wesley, played by John Barinholtz, mourns his catamaran. And Elliot, played by Humphrey Kerr, cements his status as the funniest lawyer this side of the good fight, strongly suggesting that everyone at Payne consider destroying some documents if they have a spare moment. The premiere establishes high stakes for Season 2, suggesting that everyone's continued employment depends on turning Payne out of its downward spiral. The show itself deserves more attention just for its quotable zingers. When a new crisis manager, played by Eric Stonestreet, talks about an unnamed superstar client, he hints, "Let's just say I am his top gun, and to make him seem normal is a mission impossible." The banter is cheerful, the will they or won't they is a bit cutesy, but American Auto feels like it's closing in on something edgier, with its cast of catastrophically unprepared executives edging their legacy company towards oblivion. Also, there's no such thing as a bad catamaran joke. Darren French is rating American Auto a B+. Accused premieres January 22nd at 9 p.m. on Fox. True anthologies, think a new story and cast every episode, are largely considered a relic of the 50s and 60s when shows like Fireside Theater, The Twilight Zone, Playhouse 90, and Alfred Hitchcock Presents proliferated. In more recent decades, the most successful episodic anthologies have tended to fall into the horror and sci-fi category. Goosebumps, Tales from the Crypt, Channel Zero, and of course, Black Mirror. Credit to Fox, then, for trying something a little different with Accused. Based on the 2010 BBC series and developed by Howard Gordon from Homeland, the crime anthology finds a new way to scare viewers with its suspenseful and at times melodramatic tales of well-meaning people making bad situations, you have the right to remain silent, worse. Every episode is named after the accused, Ava's story, Billy's story, etc., and begins with the protagonist in custody, awaiting legal judgment for his or her crime. The setups are dark and deceptively simple. An anguished father, played by Malcolm Jamal Warner, pressures a detective, played by Wendell Pierce, to find the man who molested his daughter. A surrogate, played by Stephanie Nogueras, worries that the deaf baby she carried is not in a safe and loving home. A veteran rock star, played by Keith Carradine, and his wife, played by Ann Carlson, try to help their adult son, played by Evan Gamble, stay sober after his latest stint in rehab. Undue stress pushes these otherwise decent folks to take ill-advised, often impulsive action, which leads to a chain reaction of moral calamity. Scott's story, penned by Gordon, is the strongest and bleakest of the five episodes made available for review. It stars Michael Chiklis as an equanimous oncologist who believes his surly teenage son, played by Oakes Fegley, is planning violent revenge against his classmates. The tense hour ends on a starkly grim and unsettling note, in contrast to the show's tendency toward last-minute uplift and courtroom speechifying. Overall, though, Accused offers well-cast, engrossing mini-mysteries with twists viewers mostly won't see coming. In the dark ages of broadcast TV, that qualifies as a glimmer of light. Kristen Baldwin is rating Accused a B. And When You Finish Saving the World is in theaters now. There's a certain kind of minor key, uniquely Sundance-y genre of a movie that might be called small epiphanies, modestly scaled indies in which fretful protagonists, melancholy, neurotic, generally upper middle class, must learn to grow and change, but not, you know, too much. When You Finish Saving the World, which premiered at the festival last year, takes its cues from that long line, a shaggy discomfort dramedy centered on the semi-estrangement between a suburban Indiana social worker named Evelyn, played by Julianne Moore, and her teenage son, an aspiring social media star named Ziggy, played by Stranger Things' Finn Wolfhard. It also happens to be the directing debut of actor Jesse Eisenberg, who has appeared in more than a few films like this. See The Squid and the Whale, Adventureland, and The Art of Self-Defense. And his experience shows in its talky, familiar contours. Stymied at home, both mother and son find outlets in other people. Evelyn with a new intake at the domestic violence shelter she oversees, a boy named Kyle, played by Billy Brick, who seems like everything Ziggy's not. Sensitive, kind, not remotely concerned with TikTok view counts. And Ziggy with a pretty self-assured classmate, played by 13 Reason Why's Alicia Beau, whose penchant for beat poetry and progressive politics put his own navel-gazing naivete in sharp relief. Never mind that his parents raised him on justice marches and protest songs, that ship sailed with puberty. Adapting the script from his own 2020 audio play, Eisenberg treats his cast with measured acidity, drawing out their snarky moods and narcissistic missteps without mocking them too cruelly. You might not particularly love these characters, but that's no match for how little they like themselves. The script, as benefits all small epiphanies, has a bigger plan for them anyway. Redemption delivered incrementally and in single-serve doses, even if the world outside remains unchanged. Leah Greenblatt is rating When You Finish Saving the World, AV. And that's it for our What to Watch article. Those were What's Worth Your Time in Movies and TV this weekend, and it was by Leah Greenblatt, Kristen Baldwin, and Darren French. We have a couple movie reviews. The first one, the Pod Generation review. You've come a long way, baby. Amelia Clark and Chiwetel Ejiofor explore the outer limits of artificial pregnancy in a sleek sci-fi satire. This is by Leah Greenblatt. What is the future of fertility? Science has been building a better baby for so long now that when a high-gloss sci-fi satire like The Pod Generation, which premiered at the Sundance Film Festival, comes along, it tends to feel less like a speculation than a roadmap. Rachel, played by Game of Thrones' erstwhile dragon queen Amelia Clark, now draped in lady business wear, and Alvy, played by Chiwetel Ejiofor, are a New York couple living in a late 21st century of streamlined convenience in which every human need, coffee, oxygen, psychotherapy, has been fully, slickly automated. That's great for Rachel, who embraces every kind of technological advancement at her job producing Siri-esque assistants. It's less appealing to Alvy, a botanist and professor whose love for the natural world reads to most people like an amusing personal quirk. Why get your hands dirty, literally, when it's all already been reproduced so prettily in holograms? So it's not surprising that when Rachel's company first offers to subsidize the cost of childbirth by paying for an artificial gestation, they'd love her to not be inconvenienced by pregnancy, she balks at telling her husband. At the womb center, babies are planted like seedlings in gleaming pods that look like a cross between some new Apple toy and a naked Fabergé, and spend their next 9 months suspended in a state of faux amniotic bliss. Each zygote's growth is optimized and their every need tended to by the pod. Parents can even choose to feed them or soothe them remotely from an app, like Tamagotchis. And Alvy does resist the idea at first, vehemently, but ease and progress, though that's not what he would call it, win out in the end. French-American filmmaker Sophie Barthes from Cold Souls and Madame Bovary finds surreal bits of wit in the details and makes it all look gorgeous. A glossy future world just absurd and specific enough to feel real. Rachel's quote-unquote therapist is a giant eyeball blinking owlishly inside a digital flower crown. Alvy's confused students recoil at the offer of a freshly plucked fig. But it's from a tree, one says incredulously. Ejiofor is eminently relatable as an analog man who can't seem to understand where it all went wrong, and Clark's eyebrows knit with such pained expressiveness, it's as if they're having their own wriggling monologue throughout the movie. Generation's targets, marriage, technology, modern parenting, also tend to feel fairly soft, low-hanging fruit if it still grew that way. And even as it hints at more sinister ends, where exactly are these wombs headed? The script eventually discards those troubling questions for a warm bath optimism that swerves into silliness in the final act. You sincerely want to see these two nice, good-looking people find better living without chemistry and make their own organic family. But the pods we haven't quite met yet no doubt have other plans. Leah Greenblatt is rating The Pod Generation a B. Next, it's Sometimes I Think About Dying. This review death becomes her. Daisy Ridley pivots from Star Wars to bittersweet indie in a Sundance breakout. This is also by Leah Greenblatt, who seems to be at Sundance right now. If beige were a person, it would probably look a lot like Fran, played by Daisy Ridley, a one office worker who moves through life like the unwitting star of her own Paxil commercial, untouched by the small joys and in-jokes of everyone around her. She's careful to keep her world cloistered, a safe Groundhog Day of spreadsheets, 10-15 bedtimes, and sad girl dinners for one. Her favorite food, naturally, is cottage cheese. The only place Fran seems to find any pleasure at all is in her fantasies. Elaborate, painterly tableau, a glimmering forest, a Viking funeral pyre, in which she splays at the center, gloriously deceased. That's the sorry deadpan gist of Sometimes I Think About Dying, a witty, surreal, and surprisingly tender character study that premiered Thursday night at the Sundance Festival, executed in impressively high style by writer-director Rachel Lambert from In the Radiant City. If Sometimes, adapted from a 2019 short story based on the play Killers by Kevin Armento, were all interior beige, we wouldn't have much reason to stay. Instead, Technicolor enters in the form of Robert, played by Canadian comedian Dave Merhagey. Robert doesn't really look like much of a savior. He's bald and bearded, a friendly goofball in rumpled dockers who loves movies and pie. But he seems impervious to Fran's protective shell, and his easy joie de vivre touches something in her stultified soul. He's happy to just take her to the movies and share a slice of blueberry crumble afterward. He even gets her to attend a house party she doesn't hate. But love, or like, or whatever this might turn out to be, isn't a magic wand to be waved over clinical depression. As the movie's two leads carry out the delicate dance of getting to know one another, Lambert cushions them in the thoughtfulness and gently skewed absurdity of her filmmaking, without tipping over into preciousness or twee. Murdergy's Robert is like a happy-go-lucky puppy, open-faced and eager to taste as much life as he can. Ridley's Fran is so reserved at first she's almost the absence of a person, but her pale scrim peels back incrementally to reveal the full extent of her damaged humanity. The supporting cast, which includes veteran character actress Marcia DeBonis and Hax's freewheeling Megan Stalter, are also uniformly great. Lambert makes lovely, low-key use of her coastal Oregon setting and the unhurried rhythms of life there, finding the divine in the details. If the ending feels abrupt and the death scenarios only teasingly explored, it's probably because we want to spend a little more time with these people. Flawed and lonely and desperate to connect, they may not be destined for great or memorable things. But for Fran, at least, and this odd, endearing movie, dying is not the end, it's how she learns to live. Leah Greenblatt is rating Sometimes I Think About Dying a B+. Jumping over to TV, Night Court Review. The revival no one asked for is actually okay. Melissa Roach stars as Judge Harry Stone's optimistic daughter in NBC's sequel to the long-running Harry Anderson comedy. This is by Kristen Baldwin. The original Night Court had a great theme song. The comedy, starring Harry Anderson as Judge Harry Stone, who presided over the oddball-filled evening shift at a dingy courthouse in New York City, ran from 1984 to 1992 on NBC. John Larroquette earned most of the laughs, and four Emmys, as the smarmy, lascivious prosecutor Dan Fielding, though the studio audience also loved Bull, the towering bald bailiff played by Richard Mall. I watched it regularly as a kid, but would be hard-pressed to recall a single episode or punchline. when 30 Rock reunited Anderson with co-stars Marky Post and Charlie Robinson for The One with the Cast of Night Court in 2008, a big part of the joke seemed to be, but did anyone ask for a reunion of Night Court? I think you know where I'm going with this. NBC is bringing back Night Court. The new series, a semi-sequel that pairs Laura Kett with The Big Bang Theory's Melissa Roach, is innocuous, quirky, and mildly amusing, like its predecessor. We may never know the why, but the what, at least, is perfectly fine. Newly installed Night Court judge Abby Stone, played by Roach, hasn't been on the bench for more than a few minutes when the burned-out public defender, played by David Thune, quits. Looking for guidance and connection to her late dad, Abby tracks down Harry's old friend and former colleague, Dan Fielding, and asks him to take the job. Anderson died in 2018. Robinson and Post passed away in 2021. Long retired and sporting a bushy FU beard, Fielding scoffs at the idea of returning to the court's nonstop freak show for about 20 of the premiere's 22 minutes. By episode 2, Dan is trading gruff wisdom and disdainful barbs with Abby and a whole new night shift gang, including standoffish prosecutor Olivia, played by India de Beaufort, anxiety-ridden clerk Neil, played by Capital Tallwalker, and gregarious bailiff Donna Gerganos, played by LaCretta. Roach is a longtime fan of the original Night Court, and she serves as an executive producer on the revival alongside her husband Winston Roach and showrunner Dan Rubin from The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. Their affection for the IP is evident in the new series, from the Easter egg props in Abby's chambers, same green couch, same stuffed armadillo named Clarence, to the general tone of determined silliness. We know Abby is kooky because she's got an oil painting of a German shepherd wearing a black robe hanging on the wall behind her desk. And we know Abby sees the defendants as more than docket numbers because she says things like, "I think if you just show a little compassion, you can put people on a better path." Abby is a relentless cat blouse wearing optimist who pushes everyone to realize their full potential. It's a testament to Roach, an adept and amiable comedian, that the character comes across as endearing instead of annoying. Laura Kett brings a new warmth to the now widowed Dan, but he still serves as the needed bitter to Abby's sweet, and he still gets all the best lines. Jump into your khakis? This is a hall of justice, not a Connecticut key party. Night Court continues to exist in a world where accused flashers wear trench coats with nothing underneath, which is weird, but also kind of sweetly nostalgic. And the theme song still slaps. For a show that none of us asked for, that's about as good as it gets. Night Court premieres Tuesday, or it premiered Tuesday, January 19th at 8 p.m. on NBC. That was the Night Court review, and it was by Kristen Baldwin. And as I'm getting to our next TV review, I'll mention that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is Entertainment Weekly magazine, and I'm actually reading from their website, EW.com. Our next TV review is The Last of Us, a post-apocalyptic drama that can't decide if it's an adaptation or a replay. Pedro Pascal and Bella Ramsey fight fungus the hard way in HBO's new series. This is by Darren French. The biggest TV shows do awful things to Pedro Pascal's face. Game of Thrones squeezed his skull to pieces. The Mandalorian helmeted him in Dad's nostalgia. A high fatality horror series sounds even nastier, so it's a nice surprise how much The Last of Us depends on the actor's kind, ungouged, visible eyes. He stars as Joel, a violent smuggler chaperoning sassy Ellie, played by Bella Ramsey, across a ruined America. Their undead odyssey is overly familiar and can play like a video game with just the talking parts. Pascal brings a lightness to gory trauma, aging himself with unkempt gray fuzz, mumbling an I reckon Texas twang, he looks like he would really be bummed about killing you. In 2003, Joel's a regular guy contractor and a single dad. A fungal infection rapidly spreads through humanity, turning victims into mad, chomping killers. These cordyceps creatures are essentially, though not technically, zombies. Civilization collapses, so J.K. Rowling never finishes Harry Potter, but also never tweets. 20 years later, Joel's living grim in Boston, one of several quarantine zones run by a residual U.S. authority called FEDRA, that's F-E-D-R-A. Beyond the walls linger monsters who used to be people, and people who are the real monsters. Joel and his partner Tess, played by Anna Torv, always welcome, receive a bodyguard assignment from the Fireflies, a rebel group. Young Ellie is a typical doomsday adolescent, masking loss behind perpetual middle finger snarl. She's also a genetic miracle. A cordyceps bite usually turns a person into an invulnerable beast defeated only by brain trauma. Zombie stuff. Somehow, Ellie survived an attack. Her DNA could save the world if Firefly scientists out west can analyze her immune system. It's a whole continent of danger from here to there, plus a personality problem. Joel don't talk much. Ellie won't stop bantering. Can a gruff badass get along with a precocious kid? The answer is obvious, which represents a bigger problem. You've seen The Last of Us already. Whether you played the hit 2013 video game or ever watched a zombie anything. The very good game was very obviously inspired by 2006's Children of Men, another cross-country quest about a sad guy shepherding a snarky, chosen teen between murderous totalitarians and murderous rebels. George Miller's filming a Mad Max, AMC's expanding The Walking Dead, and a new Planet of the Apes arrives next year. All these current facts were also true a decade ago. What's different with this Armageddon? Star power, an HBO sheen, a music budget. The scope is vast. For better, soaring vistas and extensive cityscapes, and for worse, one of the premiere's two prologues is pointless. There are big deal guest leads. The action is fine, functional. One episode completely shifts the game's canon, but some scenes get recreated shot for shot. That may work best for newbies or fans who prefer adaptations barely adapted. It contributes to the feeling of watching someone else's replay. There's a Walking Dead problem, too. AMC's franchise has lasted forever enough to explore so many post-breakdown societies, walled earthy commune, remnant government fascism, obvious cult, surprise cult. Without spoiling anything specific, Last of Us doesn't reinvent any wheels there. Joel and Ellie go various places populated by a charismatic leader and barely named followers. The undead action beats are clockwork, quiet footsteps, sudden attack, a head getting shoot-stabbed, that uneasy post-assault pause when someone realizes they got bit. The fun with any formula is the variables. The game stood out for sheer gorgeousness. Co-directors Bruce Straley and Neil Druckmann built Eden in ruins, flooding empty downtowns with reforested green. It was serene, the High Line without tourists, in a year when World War Z went shaky cam and Dark was in the titles of bad Star Trek and Thor sequels. Druckmann executive produces the TV series with Craig Mazin, a former spoof artist who nailed somber historical terror with 2019's Chernobyl. They're aiming for humanist zombie horror, which means the cordyceps don't appear as often as they might. The game made merry with the quote-unquote clickers, blind echolocators who react to noise. A thriller could have fun with that. Cripes, A Quiet Place made a universe out of it. And the show also reveals its creatures share a hive mind. Alas, those concepts fade to undead mush. The character-first focus is admirable, and there are moments of sweetness with the main duo, but their dynamic feels obvious. Does Joel need an origin-sized hole in his heart? And I wish Ellie didn't come off like the last of the grungies, prone to outright Bartisms like, "No way! Check me out, man!" and "Dude, you've got to go up in the sky." I think you're meant to be surprised by her toughness, but everyone knows Ramsey was Thrones' tween badass. She gets trickier material in a late flashback, and Last of Us comes to life in breakaways like that. The lovely third episode tangents off the main characters and features two actors whose arrival made me yelp with glee. An unexpected situation rewrites the game's canon and plays out in an unconventional form that ignores the survive somewhere new level structure. Nothing else in the 9-part debut season pops like that. It's never clear why the game's 2013 outbreak has been transposed to 2003. Cultural references feel frozen from earlier. Aha, Linda Ronstadt, Mortal Kombat 2, cassette tapes. I worry the shift is just a cheat code, allowing Mazin and Druckmann to avoid dramatizing what social media does to pandemics. A confounding situation every Earthling now knows. On the other hand, the cast is swell. Melanie Lynskey, Storm Reid, Scott Shepard, Rutina Wesley. And the way Pascal smiles when Joel finds Chef Boyardee just kills me. The finale edges in an unsettling direction, and future seasons could offer more episode 3-style experimentation. Right now, The Last of Us is less sensitive than sentimental, an end times fable where the apocalypse is a bonding experience and guns are better antiviral defenses than masks. Darren French is rating The Last of Us a B-. We've heard a couple of references to the Sundance Festival in this episode, and there's an article here, Sundance 2023 Must List, the 20 movies to see at this year's festival. This is probably good because we'll be hearing about these movies throughout the year. Jonathan Majors, Daisy Ridley, and Cousin Greg make our cut of the most anticipated narrative features and documentaries at the 2023 Sundance Film Festival. This is by Leah Greenblatt and Joshua Rothkopf. After 2 years as a virtual online event due to COVID complications, the legendary Park City gathering for indie film lovers comes off the couch with its first full-blown in-person festival since 2020. Come opening night this Thursday, and this was written on January 17th, we'll be on the ground with reviews, interviews, news, and more. But in advance, here are 20 of the most intriguing projects on deck, from a viral New Yorker story to tales of gay luchadores, pubescent supermodels, and, we hope, a major discovery or two. The first to mention is Magazine Dreams. Before he comes out swinging in Creed 3 this March and slips into the Marvel multiverse as Kang, Lovecraft Country's Jonathan Majors takes on another kind of physicality as an amateur bodybuilder struggling to connect, from a 2020 blacklist script by writer-director Elijah Bynum from Hot Summer Nights, Zola's Taylor Page co-stars. Cat Person. First published in The New Yorker, Kristen Rupanian's 2017 short story was delicate yet powerful, specific to the details of aggressive millennial dating, but suggestive enough to resonate as a hashtag MeToo corollary. Amelia Jones from Coda and Nicholas Brown from Succession star in the movie version, directed by one of the co-writers on Booksmart, and it's been whispered shaped into more of a thriller. Infinity Pool. The more Cronenberg's working, the better. Even though the king of body horror recently returned to squishy form with last year's Crimes of the Future, son Brandon from Possessor continues to show promise as a voice of his own, equally drawn to extremes. This time he's got Pearl's Mia Goth in the mix, which is only a good thing. Little Richard, I Am Everything. There is nothing small about the life of one of popular music's most enduring and least understood iconoclasts. Producer Lisa Cortez from All In, The Fight for Democracy, goes deep on both the man and the myth in her directing debut, already set for release on CNN and HBO Max. Landscape with Invisible Hand. Writer-director Corey Finley's Secret Subject, already explored twice with sharp results in Thoroughbreds and Bad Education, is class. One can hope that Finley's latest, a sci-fi pivot concerning the haves and have-nots after a mostly benevolent alien invasion, will serve up more of what he does exquisitely well. Bad Behavior. Jennifer Connelly is a former child star in search of enlightenment. Ben Whipshaw is the spiritual guide she lands on, and Australian actress Alice Englert from You Won't Be Alone plays her on-screen daughter and, twist, also directs. Still, a Michael J. Fox movie. Fox's tireless war against Parkinson's disease has, over the years, become more defining than his too brief span behind the wheel of a DeLorean time machine. Documentary director Davis Guggenheim from An Inconvenient Truth and It Might Get Loud shapes the actor's life story into the rousing profile it deserves. Passages. Sundance stalwart Ira Sachs from Frankie and Love is Strange is known for his intimate micro-budget indies. Here he goes bigger and, by all accounts, gets wildly horny in a romantic drama starring Ben Whipshaw and the great German actor Franz Rogowski as longtime lovers, and Blue is the Warmest Colors' Adele Exarchopoulos is the woman who comes between them. You Hurt My Feelings. Ah, Sundance! Movies about neurotic novelists, side-eyed marital tensions, and hurt feelings. We wouldn't have it any other way, and this one contains all of the above, plus Julia Louis-Dreyfus and The Crown's Tobias Menzies. Shepherded by the queen of small-scale urbane psychodrama, writer-director Nicole Holofcener. My Animal. If you see one queer werewolf romance this season, you might want to make it Animal, starring Bobby Salvador-Munez and Bodies, 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 Amandla Stenberg, in a hyper-contemporary thriller that may or may not howl at the moon. Judy Blume, Forever. Forever isn't such a long time, not when it comes to the quietly groundbreaking Blume, the super fudge author who trailblazed honest young adult fiction before that term was even coined. She makes a modest, appealing subject, but her letter-writing superfans turned this profile into something powerfully emotional. Cassandro. Oscar-winning documentarian Roger Ross Williams from Music by Prudence makes his narrative debut with Gael Garcia Bernal in the title role of Saul Armendariz, the real-life amateur wrestler from El Paso whose sexuality made him an unlikely pioneer in a sport already not exactly lacking for flamboyant color. 1001. The bond between a mother and son is the foundation of many a Sundance stunner, and this entry, the feature directorial debut of A.V. Rockwell, looks to follow suit. It's about a troubled single parent, played by Coming to America's Teyana Taylor, who steals her own 6-year-old from foster care in order to rebuild a life together. Eileen. Last Night in Soho's Thomasin McKenzie is a shy loner in 1960s Boston who falls in with a seductive work friend played by Anne Hathaway in an adaptation of the sticky pitch black novel by My Year of Rest and Relaxation author Otessa Moshfegh. Moshfegh also co-wrote last year's quietly affecting Jennifer Lawrence drama Causeway, but don't expect a tonal repeat here. All Dirt Roads Taste of Salt, produced by no less a bold type name than Moonlight's Barry Jenkins, the film has already been picked up by taste-making distributor A24. This Mississippi-set coming-of-age drama sounds like the arrival of a major new voice, attuned to nuances of weather and rural tensions, like a young David Gordon Green. She is writer-director Raven Jackson. Sometimes I Think About Dying, which we just heard about. Daisy Ridley is a depressive cubicle drone in rural Oregon, drawn to a new coworker, played by Dave Meherji, who makes her feel alive, or at least less like dying. In a feature-length expansion of the 2016 short by Rachel Lambert from In the Radiant City. Birth, Rebirth. Is this image too much of a giveaway? And the image that they have here is two people that look like they're sitting in a bedroom. One is sitting on the floor up against a cabinet, and the other one is crouching in a wide doorway, and you see the rest of the house in the background. I don't know how that's a giveaway. This continues on to say, suffice to say, this entry arrives in the midnight section, one that famously launched the Blair Witch Project, The Babadook, It Follows, and Hereditary. It also takes its cues from Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. Don't go reanimating the dead, unless, of course, you're making a future horror favorite. The Pod Generation, also one that we just heard about. Rachel, played by Game of Thrones' Emilia Clarke, and Alvy, played by Chiwetel Ejiofor, are a couple struggling with fertility in a near-future world. Are artificial wombs the answer? Only Sophie Barthe's creeping social satire knows for sure. Rotting in the Sun, writer-director Sebastian Silva from The Maid and Tyrell has a dependably perverse sense of humor. His films knock your jaw slack with riskiness. In Silva's latest, he plays a snide, drug-addled version of himself, a depressed artist forced to take a vacation on which he comes into contact with a likes-thirsty influencer. And our last one is Pretty Baby Brooke Shields. Documentary filmmaker Lana Wilson, who brought the Taylor Swift story Miss Americana to Sundance 3 years ago, turns her lens on Shields, another icon of young womanhood with her own cautionary tales of precocious adolescence and pop culture maelstroms to tell. Those were all from the Sundance 2023 Must List, the 20 movies to see at this year's festival. It was by Leah Greenblatt and Joshua Rothkopf. Well, I do have time for that last article that I hinted at. It is the 33 best TV episodes of 2022. It is a year-end article from December, but I've been holding it in case there was time for it. I won't be able to finish it this week, but I will get into some of it probably next week, too. I like this article because while I haven't seen all the shows, I am intrigued by what they think is the very best of each. So I might end up going back and watching some shows because of this, and maybe you will too. The description is featuring house-flipping vampires, intergalactic prison breaks, and lip-sync showdowns, and more. This is by the Entertainment Weekly staff. Justice for the TV episode. In this never-ending era of peak TV, too many showrunners have embraced the 12-hour movie, structuring their story as one sprawling, shapeless binge. But there's a particular magic to a well-crafted episode of television, whether it's a jaw-dropping finale or a creative experiment in the middle of the season. So, as 2022 draws to a close, we took it upon ourselves to rank the best TV episodes of the year. The result is a delightfully eclectic list ranging from critically acclaimed dramas to buzzy reality shows, with plenty of variety in between. Some are colossal 80-minute epics, Stranger Things, while others clock in at less than 10 minutes. Shout out to Bluey. But every episode on this list is magical in its own way, with picks stretching across networks and genres. Here are Entertainment Weekly's picks for the 33 best TV episodes of the year, and they're listed alphabetically by show. Abbott Elementary. The episode is named Desking, and it's on ABC. It's written by Morgan Murphy and directed by Melissa Kosar. Abbott Elementary has offered no shortage of delights over the course of its first and second seasons, but Desking was a comedic A+, perfectly capturing the zany relatability of the show. When TikTok sparks the trend of desking, aka sprinting across the tops of desks while a teacher's back is turned, the Abbott staff is beside themselves. At its heart, Abbott is about a group of flawed individuals doing their best in a broken system, and desking encapsulates that through the rise and fall of a viral trend. The notion of desking itself is hilarious. A TikTok challenge so dangerous and stupid it feels real. But the episode's most piercing humor lies in the escalating helplessness of the teachers and the physical comedy of their Pyrrhic victory in making desking uncool. Throw in Cheryl Lee Ralph's iconic delivery of Sweet Baby Jesus and the Grown One Too, and it's clear that when it comes to crafting iconic moments in comedy television history, Kingdom Brinson understands the assignment. The After Party. The episode is named Jasper, and that's on Apple TV+. Even among a wealth of pop culture murder mysteries, The After Party shines thanks to its central concept, where each character gets their own episode, styled in a unique genre benefiting of that person. Even still, the musical-themed Jasper stands out among them as the best in show. It's impossible to resist Ben Schwartz's portrayal of his high-energy character, coupled with insanely catchy songs, really great choreography, and an abundance of ingenious hidden clues. Even though you know you're watching what could be a prime suspect in a cold-blooded murder, you can't help but love Jasper, and that's a testament to the episode's brilliance. And I will say that's episode 3, which I have told people to watch The After Party and at least get to this episode, because it's a good one. Andor, One Way Out, is on Disney+. There's only one way to watch Andor's 10th episode, on the edge of your seat. One Way Out is the gripping climax of the show's prison trilogy, which finds future rebel Cassian, played by Diego Luna, wrongly held by the Empire in a sterile, dystopian jail straight out of THX-1138. Luckily for him, he's sharing a cell block with Kino Loy, played by series MVP Andy Serkis, in human form this time. The tough but respected day shift manager who oversees the inmates' dehumanizing factory labor. When the truth finally hits that they'll never be released, Cassian and Kino hatch a high-stakes plan to escape, culminating in a spectacular endorphin-spiking sequence that takes full advantage of Serkis's physicality and gravitas. While the show is named after Cassian, it wisely puts the spotlight on new players like Kino and shadowy spymaster Lucen Rael, played by Stellan Skarsgård, so it can examine a rebellion in the making from every angle. By being laser-focused on character and theme instead of endless Easter eggs, Star Wars feels more vital than it has in years. Atlanta is the next show, and the episode is The Goof Who Sat by the Door. Atlanta is on FX. The most exciting thing about turning on an episode of Atlanta during its final two seasons, which both aired in 2022, is that you never knew what you were going to get. You didn't know where it would take place. You didn't know what tone it would adopt, Hell, you didn't even know if any of the four series stars would appear in it. But even when trained to expect the unexpected, no one could have prepared for The Goof Who Sat by the Door. Presented as a faux documentary on the Black American Network, the episode, directed by series creator Donald Glover, tells the fictional tale of Thomas Washington, who becomes Disney CEO by accident and then loses everything in an attempt to make the blackest film of all time. That film? A goofy movie. Yes, that a goofy movie. Not only does this brilliant installment provide sly and cutting social commentary throughout, but it also somehow does the impossible, using the relationship between anthropomorphic father and son dogs on screen to somehow make you care deeply about a man who never even existed off of it. Bad Sisters is the next show, and the episode is Splash. Bad Sisters is on Apple TV. An egregiously underrated dark comedy, at least in the press, not in the many, many minds of those who found it through word of mouth, Bad Sisters from catastrophe mastermind Sharon Horgan deserved its promotion from limited series to serial as Apple renewed it for season two. Splash, the show's sixth episode, is a great example why. The show chronicles the lives of four Irish sisters and their fifth sibling who's locked in an abusive marriage. Split between two timelines, the Garvey gals attempt to murder their brother-in-law, John Paul, played by Claes Bang, but all their plans go terribly awry. Splash sees one of the most bold schemes backfire. Drugged by Rohinol slipped into his daily nose spray, John Paul wakes in a daze as the Garveys are hiding in closets and beneath the bed. The knucklehead shenanigans that ensue, complete with John Paul peeing on a carpet in the corner before recklessly driving to the docks, plummeting into the water, and rising later to think, maybe someone's trying to kill me, are the highlight of physical comedy. Better Call Saul, Fun and Games on AMC. Of all the farewells in the final season of Better Call Saul, the severing of Jimmy, played by Bob Odenkirk, and Kim's, played by Rhea Seehorn's, relationship was the most dreaded, the least violent, and the most resonant. After the striving and conniving lawyers plan to damage Howard, played by Patrick Fabian, spun deathly out of control, enigmatic Kim did the unexpected again. She walked away from her beloved profession in court and then leveled with a begging and bargaining Jimmy. Their breakup scene, full of reversing momentums, another in a season of mesmerizing performances by Seahorn and Odenkirk, was a perfectly unsettling end to one of TV's most unconventional couples. Cartel consequences rippled elsewhere as Gus, played by Giancarlo Esposito, fleetingly dropped his guard with a sommelier, played by Reed Diamond. Nacho's grieving dad, played by Juan Carlos Cantu, delivered a hard truth to code-adhering Mike, played by Jonathan Banks. But true tragedy loomed in the final minutes when a flash-forward revealed Saul Goodman living in hollowed-out, gaudy excess. Gold toilet, rotating leopard-spotted bed, and not a moral anywhere to be found. Bluey is our next show, and the episode is Rain. That airs on ABC Kids. What makes Bluey so magical is that it not only understands the wonders and frustrations of the parent-child relationship, but portrays it in a way that's not cloying or cliched. In this season 3 standout, a sudden thunderstorm creates a tiny river on the sidewalk, and Bluey, in her fervor to build a small dam, creates one mess after another, much to Mom Chili's consternation. Almost completely without dialogue, a silent movie plays out between a determined kid and a frustrated mother who eventually sees the wonder in the falling water. There were many great episodes in season 3, Facey Time remains a hilarious delight, but Rain is a beautiful little tone poem that perfectly demonstrates why Bluey is one of the most special shows on TV right now. The Bear, That's the name of the next show, and the episode is Review. This airs on FX on Hulu. Like Sydney's expertly crafted cola-braised short rib and risotto, episode 7 of the Bears freshman season is damn near perfect. Almost the entire episode is dedicated to one long, uninterrupted take, which follows